It's an all-time record. The current administration has imposed 600 major new federal rules and regulations and is said to have at least 50 more on the way. You can tell major rules and regulations from regular old day-to-day ones because major regulations are the ones that cost over $100 million to implement. Now, given all these federal rules and regulations that are piled up on top of all the old federal rules and regulations, put them together with all the old and new state rules and regulations and the local ones as well, why, we simply must ask, can farmers farm our food without breaking the rules?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 1068th edition of the Food Chain Radio Show right here on the GCN Radio Network. Or hey, perhaps from among our friends down there in Guaymas who are tuned in as we stream along on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio, with engineer Jason Struby on the boards. Hello, Jason.
It's my pleasure to be here.
I have a question for you.
Fire away.
Do you think it's possible for you to get through the day without breaking a rule, a regulation, or a law?
Plead the fifth.
I rode my bicycle into to the studio today, and there weren't many people on the road, so I think I broke a few.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, it's terrible. Hey, folks, if it rains on your property and runs down into the gutter and into the drain and then into a creek and then into a river, your property would belong to the Environmental Protection Agency and the Army Corps of Engineers. If that rain had picked up some motor oil from your leaky old Buick and carried that down the stream, you might well find yourself with a cease and desist order in your hand and a potential fine of like $75,000 a day. Now, before you feel sorry for yourself, consider the plight of the American farmer, who has lots of acres upon which rain falls and runs off. Such would be the case if the administration succeeds in enacting its Waters of the U.S. rule change to the Clean Water Act. But the Waters of the U.S. rule is just one rule. In fact, government has issued an all-time record 600 major new rules and regulations. The major rule costs over $100 million to implement. 50 more major rules are on the way, so be ready. Given the overwhelming weight of all the rules and regulations being put forth and the costs of complying with those rules and regulations and the vulnerability of American farmers who are stuck standing out there in their fields, we just have to ask, can farmers farm our food without breaking the rules? Well, here to help us come to grips with that, we have a genuine American farmer. His name is Dick Pichot, Lakeside Organic Gardens in the beautiful Pajaro Valley of California. Dick, welcome to the Food Chain.
Morning.
Pleased to have you aboard. Now, Lakeside Organic Gardens, this is what it says on your website. Lakeside Organic Gardens is the largest family-owned and operated solely organic vegetable grower-shipper in the USA, producing over 45 commodities year-round. And you're committed to being 100% organically grown in California. Dick, you come from, like everybody, you came from a long line of farmers. Your grandfather was a potato farmer in the Azores. Our family matriculated to California, and you continued farming. So I have to ask, why did you stay in farming when all the rest of us moved into town to chase Pokemon?
That's a great question. I don't know, I just gathered interest when I was very young. When I used to ride around with my dad when I was young and just gathered interest in farming and decided when I was like 17 to start farming on my own, and started my own farm of 40 acres and just grew it up over the years, and it's kind of always been in my blood, I guess.
Always been in your blood. Well, I guess it's always in everybody's blood, but when it gets right down to it, because, you know, all of us can go back a few generations and find agriculture in our family. Maybe a few more generations than the others, but when it gets right down to it, it's always there somewhere. Your parents are farmers, your grandparents are farmers, you're farmers. Now, you're very big on farming with, I guess you're the genuine definition of a family farmer. Because when one looks at Lakeside Organic Gardens, wow, a whole bunch of family there.
Yes, we have quite a few of our, my kids are involved, and my brothers and sisters are involved, and my mother used to run the office for me when she was alive, and it's been kind of a family operation ever since inception.
You know, kind of a parenthetical, but can you think of any other occupation that's better at holding a family together than a successful farm?
I definitely can't. We actually get along really well, and we each have defined territories of what we do, and we work really well together.
Well, how many defined areas are there on your farm? I mean, if you were just to take a wild guess.
There's probably 30 different defined areas to cover within that.
So 30 different job positions that need to be filled in the Lakeside Organic Gardens. Now, it's kind of hard for people to understand just how complex your business is, so I'd kind of like to go through that with you, if I might. So you say you grow 45 different commodities. Well, what kind of commodities do you grow?
They're all vegetables, so everything from, you know, from lettuces and broccoli and cauliflower and celery and you know, we do a lot of specialty crops like cilantro and dill and parsley, and then we get into summer crops like zucchini and peppers and cucumbers, eggplant. So it's just a real diverse group of crops.
Right. Now, each one of those crops, of course, each one of those commodities or plants require special kinds of growing conditions, right? I mean, they each grow differently.
Absolutely, yeah. Some require a different climate than others, too, and that's what we're fortunate here in the Paro Valley, because we have cooler climate at the coast and warmer climate inland, so all require different water requirements in the.
So you, as farmer, have to take care of the growing needs of, like, 45 children.
Yeah, pretty much so.
Each one of them different.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Each one of them requiring different kinds of care. So do you plant each one of those crops just once a year?
No, they're planted pretty much all throughout the year. So, you know, some are once a week, some are every 2 weeks, and some are every other day. So depends on the crop. But there's like 40 different schedules that they all run on out there. So every crop has a different schedule, different days to harvest, and all that. So it's...
Would you give us an example, let's say, cilantro and lettuce?
Mm-hmm. So, yes, the cilantro, we plant like 2 acre blocks every 5 days through the summertime. But then in the fall, when the East Coast starts getting cold and getting frost, then we'll size that up to every 3 to 4 days we'll plant 2 acres to increase the production at that time. So... And then as you go into fall, you have to plant heavier, closer, because it takes longer to get to harvest. So it's adjusted as the day goes on. So it starts out 45 days in the summertime, and it could get up as long as 60 days in the, either through the wintertime. And then we'll go down to the desert for the dead of the winter. We have a farm down there in the dead of the winter down there.
Okay.
And then lettuce is a longer crop, 60 to 70 days. We usually plant five or six different lettuces together in one field. So they're like red leaf and romaine and green leaf. And we plant all those together. And they all harvest pretty much at the same time. And those we plant every 3 days. We plant 2 blocks a week, four acre blocks twice a week.
Now, how many ranches do you use to grow all of these crops?
So we have 52 different parcels here in the Paro Valley, 52 different ranches. And then those are all broken into smaller blocks.
Okay.
And this will be up to
so I'm trying to come to grips with the complexity, and I've lost track. You grow 45 different crops, some of which you plant every other day. You plant them in 40 different plots. It's like in a symphony of activity. How in the heck do you keep track of it?
it's pretty much a full-time job. So,
do you like have a supercomputer or something in your truck?
Not really. It's about iPads, about as far as I go. But all this is something I kind of grew up with, and so I've learned over the years to manage and to.
Okay, so we have all of that complexity. Now we're going to throw in government. Folks, this is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio with Dick Pichot, Lakeside Organic Gardens, nation's largest purely organic farmer, growing our vegetables that feed us all throughout the year. Do stay tuned. We're going to ask him what happens when government comes to town.
Wow, MetroFarm.com says we can earn a 5-, 6-, or 7-figure income by farming a small parcel of land in or near the city.
And we don't even have to own the land. We can lease it year to year.
MetroFarm.com says we can grow fruit on prairie bench lands, houseplants in coastal valleys, vegetables in city greenbelts, and ornamentals in neighborhoods of fancy homes.
We can even grow flowers on our wooded hillside.
Get all the information you need to grow for profit at MetroFarm.com, including the complete guide to earning 5-, 6-, and 7-figure incomes by farming small parcels of land. Meet the farmers who earn the money. Find experts at MetroFarm.com who will examine your property and assess which crops to grow. Meet consultants who will help steer your project to profitability. And get the latest news about the business of growing high-value specialty crops for the city at MetroFarm.com.
We've always dreamed about farming a small parcel of land. At MetroFarm.com, we can get all the help we need to stop dreaming and start growing.
Well, folks, it doesn't take much imagination to see the farmer out there in the field, his or her field, as being a very vulnerable position. Sitting there on the cab of his tractor, his or her tractor, and on the pickup and tending the field, they're there right in front of everybody to see. And by golly, they're out there making dust fly into the air and they're irrigating crops and, oh my goodness, very, very dirty business. So when it comes to regulating anybody, let's start with farmers because they are so easy to get. True enough, Dick Pichot?
Yeah, that's for sure.
So, you've been doing this for a long, long time. Take us back to when you started and, you know, kind of give us a progression on the regulatory environment of government. When you first started, what was it like and what's it like today?
Well, back then it was mainly we were farmers. We would just go out and farm the crops, grow the crop. That was our toughest challenge, you know, and people asked me, organic farming, what's your toughest pest to control? And today it's definitely government regulation. That's our biggest pest, and it's something that we have nothing to really control with other than our votes. And so it's pretty frustrating because, there was a fellow running for governor a few years back, and he wanted to come out and spend a day on the farm and take some photo ops of, seeing what a farmer does. And he wanted to come out and move pipe and, a drive tractor. And I told him, I said, today, if you're a farmer, I said, you have to sit behind a desk and fill out paperwork for the government. That's what a lot of what farming involves today. It's unfortunately, I'd love to go out and move pipe and drive tractor, but there's just so much government regulation that doesn't allow us to do what we want to do. So if you want to come and spend a day on the farm, bring your paperwork with you and you can fill out all paperwork for the government. He said, oh, no, I don't, that won't look good. So I said,
how much of your time do you, you've got 40 commodity crops, some of which you plant every other day on 45 commodity crops, 40 different parcels of land. Minding that complexity must be staggering. But how much of your time and intellectual firepower is taken up with the government paperwork?
Well, fortunately for us, for the size operation we have, we're able to hire people to take care of regulation. We have a compliance director that takes care of government regulation. We have food safety people that take care of that. We have worker safety people in HR that take care of that. And so in our size operation, we can do that. Now, I have a lot of my friends that are very small farmers, and they're having a lot tougher time, really, because they just flat out can't follow the law because they don't have the resources to, you know, to hire people to do it. So, you know, sometimes our people will help them get through, get set up to get take care of their food safety and different issues like that. And we have helped quite a few smaller farmers to try to get set up on the right program. But for us, I mean, we blended across all of those acres, even though it's...
So you have the economies of scale sufficient to be able to pay to have the job done, whereas those people who lack the economies of scale, maybe only have an acre of something, the costs are extraordinary.
Absolutely. It'd be virtually impossible for, it's impossible for any of us to follow all the laws. Like you just mentioned, 600 new laws. I mean, you know, just try to read the laws, let alone obey them, you know, and there are so many that are conflicting, you know. I mean, one says, for instance, we farm down at College Lake, and one state agency says that we need to maintain our facilities and clean the ditches and keep those maintained. And then the Fish and Game comes in and says, you know, you can't touch those ditches or you'll be in violation of federal law. And so they can't even agree amongst themselves. They said, well, we throw it back at them. And they go, well, we're both right. You just can't. You can't keep one happy. You're going to get thrown in jail by one or the other for not following the law. So those are the kind of things that we have to
do. You know, there used to be a popular expression for that. It was catch 22. So you're guilty if you do. You're guilty if you don't.
Absolutely, yeah. And
so how did you resolve that? What did you do?
Let's see. Well, the ditches magically got cleaned on a weekend when nobody's looking, and they're operating there. Everything's fine now, and the fish are swimming upstream like they should, and the drainage is working like it should, but we're basically in violation of multiple laws, I'm sure.
So, wow.
Yeah, so.
So, you know, I just think of some of the new regulations that have been passed. You know, farmers being a very dirty people, so the government steps in, got to have a Clean Water Act, and we're going to institute this Waters of the U.S. rule change, where any water that runs off your property and that flows into a ditch and then flows into a river and flows into the ocean now comes under the purview of the Environmental Protection Agency and the Army Corps of Engineers. And with that nexus, that connection between your property and the distant ocean, they want to make rules that apply to everybody across the board and thus kind of institute these massive control mechanisms. And the same is true with air. Just in today's Wall Street Journal, the California Air Resources Board wants dairy farmers to, get this, purchase technology to capture methane and then sell the biogas to consumers. The problem is there are no devices that really do that. So are farmers really this dirty?
You know, we're really the ultimate environmentalists because, you know, it's in our best interest to protect all the environment that we're in. I mean, we spend a lot of our business just watching the sustainability of the farm and the sustainability of the ground and what we farm, and water resources are part of that, you know. And so as time goes on, we just continue to place more value on having the ground in good shape and having the water in good shape, you know. But the rules they're writing are impossible to follow, and I have a real strong feeling that if you write rules that are impossible to follow, you really lose a focus on what, you know, what you're really after. And so, and I think government's kind of gotten to that point now where they're so busy writing regulations that they can't really even see that it's impossible to follow them. And if we did follow them, we'd be, you know, out of business. I mean, you know, one of the analogies is like down south and where we farm down in Imperial Valley in the wintertime. We have a ranch down there to get production in the winter. And we farm 5 miles from the Mexican border. And so our government says we have to follow all these environmental regulations, the water runoff, the air pollution, all the labor laws and everything else. But our same government under NAFTA allows product come from San Luis Valley right across the border literally 10 miles to come across the border and them to harvest with, you know, with, you know, subpaid labor that's paid less than they're over there in Mexico with no regulations and none of the regulation I deal. But they can bring that product across at tonight and put it in the cooler right alongside our, and then they call that fair trade. And I kind of failed to see why that is fair, that we should apply to all these rules to us because we do the right thing. And we're, if you look at our website, we're really committed to farming in the U.S. and we're committed to farming in California. And but then product comes across the Mexican border that doesn't have to follow any of the regulations. And they say, oh, that's fair trade. And I really fail to see that. But that's our government that sets these systems up. And,
well, so many in business and in agriculture have, you know, stared in the face of these rules and regulations and said, the hell with it, I'm out of here. And, you know, went and got a piece of land, you know, just across the border to build a factory or to grow food. And then, of course, they become new worlders, I guess, and advocate for open borders. Because that's then their advantage. They have no rules, and you have the rules. So I guess we're back to this vulnerability of farmers here in the United States who are out there in the field and are so easy to regulate and so easy to put upon new regulations to make our country so clean. How on earth are they going to be able to farm without breaking the rules? That's the question we have today. What about you out there? Are you facing the same situation that Dick Pichot and everybody else in agriculture is? Or which rules and regulations are coming to bite you? This is the Food Chain, 831-479-1080. We will be right back. Not too far down the road, John Steinbeck wrote The Grapes of Wrath, all about the Judd family and the terrors of working on farms with farm workers. And, of course, Cesar Chavez was in the neighborhood, too. Now, farmers are especially vulnerable because they require a lot of people's hands to grow and produce the crops that we eat. And, of course, Those farm workers are always portrayed in the media as being put upon by farmers and treated unfairly and miserably. We know that Dick Pichot is not one of those farmers because when the neighboring workers on the neighboring farms go on strike, Dick's workers do not. They stay aboard and seem to be pretty darn happy with being able to work on his farms. So how do you do that anyway?
I think, you know, a lot of it is at Lakeside, you know, we're committed to the workers that are really our biggest asset that we have in the company, and it's what makes the company work. And
But how do you make them that way? I mean, how do you get them to be an asset instead of a liability?
Well, I think they all have incentives. You know, most of the workers work on piece rate, and so it's up to them how hard they want to work, how much they want to make. We guarantee an hourly wage, but then it's up to them how much they want to make. And then the other thing too is we're really firm believers that we're all part of a chain to make the company work. And so at the end of every year, I personally look at the balance sheet and see if the company made money. And if the company made money, then it's really important to give back to the workers. So it's not only their wages. They all get bonuses. I'm not one to say, well, upper management's going to get these $1 million bonuses. It's really going to go back to every worker. So we have about 300 employees, and after for the last 5 years, we've given 100% of them bonuses.
Mm-hmm.
It's all part of, you know, of them being part of the team and part of the family of Lakeside.
And yet, still, agriculture is portrayed as being mean and cruel to workers. You're part of agriculture, so I guess you get stuck with some of that broad brushism as well, even though you're not. And so what government does is that it makes rules and regulations to make things fair for farm workers. And how have those rules changed over the years that you've been in business, Dick?
The rules and regulations are just almost ridiculous. I mean, I grew up on working for different farmers there when I was 8, 9, 10 years old. And back then, you get a work permit to go to work, and you could work reasonable. You'd work alongside the other workers there. And nowadays, the regulations, you know, it's now defined as child labor, so we can't even send our own kids out to the field to work a normal day. They have to work, you know, have, you know, 2 hours, and then they have to have a break, and then they have to, you know, they can work 3 hours in this one and 4 hours over that, but they can't, there's no consistent schedule they can do. Back when I was at a work permit, I basically picked berries for a Driscoll strawberry grower at the time, and me and my brothers and sisters, we just worked right alongside the other guys. And so it really, it taught us work ethic back then because we were a part of the crew. And nowadays, you almost, if you have kids come to work, you have to regulate them to the point where they can't really learn how it all operates. And it's pretty frustrating because I think there is a lot of good kids that want to get out and work on the farm. And I think it's a great experience for them to be able to go out there and do farm work. And it teaches them a lot, you know. So
I often think that, you know, taking kids off the farm was probably the worst mistake civilization ever did, because where else can they find that work experience, you know, that ethic of what it takes? If you don't do the work, the crops don't grow. Simple as that. So where do children get? I guess that's just a complaint from me then. So you can't hire kids to go out and pick the berries anymore. What about the rest of the farm workers? You know, they're talking about raising the minimum wage to $15 an hour and the fair labor practices. Do you have to have a compliance officer to watch over all of those things for you?
Definitely, yeah. I have three people that work in HR to watch all the regulations that go on. And it's really, you know, one of the biggest things that's happened in the last couple of years is we've paid piece rate for years, which is, you know, so much per box for harvesting, mm-hmm. whatever. So last year they came down with a regulation that said that it was an interpretation of the law, and it's never happened as far as I know, but it's going to set a new precedent for law. So we have annual audits from the Labor Department comes in and checks our books to make sure that we're paying according to the law. And for every year for the last 10 years, there's been no violations, no nothing wrong, everything's fine. But then it changed the interpretation of the law last year that said when they're paying a piece rate, we have to singulate out their break time because we're required to give them break times, which we do. But they said that we have to singulate that out and make sure that they get paid separately for that. And because we weren't doing that, we were in violation of the law. And so we said, okay, if that's the way it's going to be, then we'll change the way we do it. And said, well, no, we're going to go retroactive and make you pay for the last 3 years, you know, for a law that was reinterpreted. But we said your books were fine the way you were doing it, but now that we've reinterpreted the law, we want you to go back actually 4 years, retroactive 4 years, to pay all the workers, you know, their back wages for what's owed to them. And if we can't find the workers, then, you know, the state will take care of that. We'll collect that money and hold it for them there. So it's just kind of pretty frustrating because you all of your pricing and all of your contracts are based off of the current labor prices and everything. And so when you get 4 years later and they say, well, you know, you have to pay this much more. And some of the growers over million, it's millions of dollars for some people to pay those, because it's not just that, but you're actually being penalized also because you didn't pay the workers correctly. But that was because it was years later that they reinterpreted the law.
So they passed the law. Everybody complied with the law for years and years and years. And then one morning they woke up and said, I think it's time to reinterpret that law, and we'll make it retroactive for 4 years. And so you just did this the right way, but now we think it's the wrong way. So you have to pay.
Right. And like I say, a lot of growers, it's in the millions of dollars. And most of that, I'd say 75 to 80% of that is penalties, which doesn't get to the workers. The workers get paid the back wages, but the penalties, you know, go to the state. So it's really a frustrating situation, and we've been battling it for a couple of years, and we've settled our case, but a lot of growers are fighting and will not financially survive. You know, I know several great farmers that are great to their employees, and go above and beyond, and they will be out of business with this interpretation of the law. They don't have the resources to do it. So
we have Eileen on the line. Eileen, welcome to the Food Chain Radio Program, Dick Pichot. We have a minute left, so you have a real quick question, and then we'll hold you over, okay?
Yeah, hi, Dick and Michael. Thanks for the show. I was just going to say, when are we going to start instituting the Constitution? I mean, because anything that is opposed to the Constitution is not a law. So all this overreach of regulation that's tying the hands of farmers and everybody else who's trying to do business, we've got to stand up and...
Okay, that's a great thought. We'll pick it up after the break. What about it, folks? Are we going to allow this to go on and on and on and on and on? This is the Food Chain Radio Program. I will be right back with Dick Pichot and Eileen and you, 831-479-1080. Welcome back, folks. This is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson here, and we're talking with Dick Pichot of Lakeside Organic Gardens. We're talking with Eileen on the phone as well. But before we go back to Eileen, a quick... something I'd like to bring up, which is, to me, is going to be one of the most onerous rules and regulations of all, and that, of course, is those relating to food safety. Some years ago, so a batch of poisoned spinach went out and sickened a lot of people, killed some. The government, never letting a serious crisis go to waste, passed the Food Safety Modernization Act of 2010, giving total and absolute control to the Food and Drug Administration over food. Now the Federal Food Police, under the direction of the former Monsanto Vice President Michael Taylor, can go to anybody's farm and confiscate, or restaurant, or commercial kitchen, and confiscate all the food with there being no recourse whatsoever. So, and the rules and regulations coming out of that are so incredible, they're just going to outlaw nature, as it were. This just in from the National Poultry Improvement Plan is meeting this week with USDA to propose regulations to mandate a 10-foot vegetation-free perimeter around all poultry flocks used for breeding. That, of course, would outlaw pasture poultry. So, Eileen, you brought up a very interesting point, that these rules and regulations are super constitutional, which means that they are just add-ons by government to take additional control. Do you think the government expects everybody to comply with these rules, or are these rules and regulations uncompliable?
I think they're uncompliable by design.
If to what purpose?
It's a form of warfare. If they can cripple the farmers and cripple everybody else in industry, and then send our jobs overseas to countries like you were saying that don't have any regulations, it's such hypocrisy. I mean, if these people are truly concerned about health and the clean coal burning, the clean coal production, and then they go over to China and get, the coal that's manufactured in very unclean situation. It's just gross hypocrisy, and people need to be educated about what's going on. And that's why I really appreciate your show, Michael.
Well, thank you very much, Eileen. Let's try and see what Pete has to say. Pete, are you there? Hello, Pete.
Oh, this is Dave.
Oh. Well, hello, Dave. Holy
shit. Hey, listen, I was just wanted to bring up the fact that somebody made a mistake after the passage of that law. Couldn't Mr. Pichot apply the ex post facto that we learned about in the eighth grade?
What does that mean?
Ex post facto means that you cannot apply a law retroactively. You pass a law today, you can't enforce it because it was wrong in the past.
Well, that's a great question. Let's see what Dick has to say. Dick?
Quite a few attorneys have been fighting this for a couple of years, and were beating our head against the wall with government's interpretation of the law. They said they didn't change the law. It was just they weren't interpreting it correctly. So there's a difference between changing the law and any interpretation. They said that they keep going back to their interpretation was not correct. So
if they... So this is what we say, and that's tough. There's no recourse. Well, you know, that's kind of what we're getting at with respect to this Food Safety Modernization Act, too. It seems like they want to take nature out of agriculture. It seems like the purpose is to separate life from crops. Am I just imagining things?
No, you're 100% on target. I mean, it's the point now where if a gopher comes up out in the field, it's our job to put flags for 10 feet around that area and stake it off that no harvest is supposed to happen around that gopher hole for 10 feet in all directions. We're to destroy that food so that it doesn't get in the food chain. If a bird flies over and, you know, and something falls out of the sky, then it's our job to search that spot out and to stake that area off and not harvest within 10 feet of that area. So this is what we're expected as farmers to do, and to, you know, all the way down any kind of a varmint, whatever. I mean, we've got 10-foot deer fences around to keep deer out, even though deer don't carry E. coli. It's a known fact. And so it's above and beyond what, you know, what beyond what's normal for food safety, and it's beyond even the science of it. So I'm, you know, firm believers in food safety, but the regulations have gone, you know, completely out of control, and at some point we have to try to get it back in the box because it's affecting our food to the point where we're destroying the supply of food that we have out there. I mean, I know of entire fields that have been dissed up because of suspicion of, you know, an irrigation practice or thing, and so and no facts to back it up. So that's what I'm hoping at some point we can get the regulations back to a fact-based as opposed to a fear-based.
Okay, putting regulations back in the box. This I got to hear. Do stay tuned. This is the Food Chain, Michael Olson with Dick Pichot. How do you get regulations when they're out of the box back in the box? 831-479-1080. Right back.
Get this. You can earn a 5-, 6-, or 7-figure income by farming a small parcel of land in or near the city.
You can be old or young.
Rich or poor.
Married or single.
You can own land outright.
Or lease it year to year.
You can grow small fruits on prairie bench lands.
House plants in coastal valleys.
Flowers on steep wooded hillsides.
Vegetables in the city green belts.
And ornamentals in neighborhoods of fancy homes.
Get all the help you need to get growing at MetroFarm.com.
Get the complete guide to growing high-value specialty crops for the city at MetroFarm.com.
Get experts to look at your land and assess which crops to grow at MetroFarm.com.
Get advice on how to plan and develop your project at MetroFarm.com.
And get news about the business of farming for the city.
Yes, you can earn a 5-, 6-, or even a 7-figure income by farming high-value specialty crops on a small parcel of land in or near the city.
Grow for the money today at MetroFarm.com. That's MetroFarm.com.
They say we spend $25 billion a year sweating it out at the gym. Sweat contains some of the essential nutrients your body needs to grow strong and stay healthy. If you sweat these nutrients out and fail to replace them, your body will begin breaking down. Some say you can get all 90 of the essential nutrients from the foods you eat. Maybe. But if you eat foods from farmed-out soils or foods that have had the life processed out of them, you will deprive your body of some essential nutrients. You can get all 90 of the essential nutrients your body needs for less than a daily latte with a 90 for Life Healthy Start Pack. It's easy, it's delicious, and they are essential.
Get all 90 of the essential nutrients your body needs to grow strong and stay healthy with a 90 for Life Healthy Start Pack at NutrientsToGo.com. That's NutrientsToGo.com. Get all 90 of the essential nutrients your body needs for less than the cost of a daily latte at NutrientsToGo.com. That's NutrientsToGo.com.
Well, Dick Pichot, as the proprietor of the largest family-owned and operated solely organic vegetable growership in the USA, can American farmers farm our food without breaking the rules, the regulations, and the laws put in place by our federal government and state government and local governments?
It's virtually impossible.
Virtually impossible. Okay, that makes you outlaws, right?
I guess so, yeah.
Okay, well, the reason I ask is that if we are all breaking the rules, and that makes us extremely vulnerable to a government that has a propensity for using its regulatory bodies, like the IRS, for example, to prosecute and to shake down, as you are in agriculture, are being shaken down for money. Holy smokes. Let's go see what Rory has to say. Rory, are you there?
I'm here. Thanks for taking my call, and great, great show. And got a question for Dick. Dick, just in your, where do you see this going in the next 5 to 10 years with these food safety regs that are now hitting the industry and both organic and conventional? I mean, they don't make any distinction. You know, organic's supposed to be pure as the wind-driven snow, but they're coming down on you guys with both feet just like everybody else. So where do you think this is going to end up?
Well, interesting question. I think it's gone a little bit too far in some respects right now. And like I say, there's research being done, but it's exceeding, you know, it's being driven more by fear than by the science of the food science.
Hey, can I ask both of you a question? You both professionals. It seems like the only safe food is dead food. Am I wrong? Is that
yeah,
what you're...
Well, or it'll have to be grown in a greenhouse where birds can't fly over. I mean, do people really want the expense of this system? I don't. I don't want all my food coming out of a greenhouse. Not that it's bad. I mean, in certain times of the year, that's fine. But I like it grown outside.
But even then,
I grow my own garden. I let birds fly over my garden. I eat the green beans and peppers and all the other stuff that comes out. No problem.
But it seems like They want to take all of the... I mean, Dick and both of you guys produce food with life, and it's filled with life. And it seems like what the government is aiming for is food that's dead, maybe made out of some kind of ground-up soybean meal and infused with artificial flavor or something. It seems like that's what they're gunning for. Am I wrong? Please tell me I'm wrong.
I mean, if you eat a tomato today, just go to any store and buy a tomato. But about 95% of the tomatoes you buy off the shelf today are produced in a greenhouse in a sterile environment. And like I say, it tastes pretty much like cardboard. You know, people say, why do things taste so bad? Because they're produced in an environment that's just it's a false environment, you know. And then go down to the farmer's market and buy an heirloom tomato and take it home and see what real food should taste like. And you'll see the difference. And
yeah,
the thing is, but the sterile environment doesn't exist out there in that heirloom tomato field that's out there and, you know, in the Hollister or whatever. So I think at some point the consumers got to, you know, vote with their pocketbook and say, we're not going to buy that, you know, tomato off the shelf anymore. We're not going to buy that, you know, that food that just tastes like wood. And we're tired of it and we want to get back to real food.
Well, Dick and Rory, we're out of time, but I want to thank both of you for standing out there in their field and being targets for a government run amok. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. And thank you all for tuning in the Food Chain. Remember Michael Olson's first law of the food chain? Agriculture is the foundation upon which we build all our sandcastles. Thank you all.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.